Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, April 14th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. We'll begin with the mini editorial, which is written today by Jean C. Conover from Mapleton. And Jean writes, "Now that Kim Reynolds has taken an axe to public education in Iowa, she is intent on stacking the judiciary with her choices for the Iowa Supreme Court. Despite objections from the Iowa Bar Association and a plurality of lawyers across the state." And again, this was written by Jean C. Conover from Mapleton. And our first story has a headline of "Search May Unearth a Missing Cemetery." Dakota City. Much like a bloodhound, Dennis Reinert has been on the trail tracking down the lost Amadi Cemetery, and that's spelled O-M-A-D-I. As he watched actual hounds sniffing through the corn stalks in the middle of a field between Dakota City and Homer on Thursday, Reinert was optimistic he is nearing the goal of discovering the location of Dakota County's oldest cemetery. "We have got a lot of evidence that indicates this is the site," Reinert said, "of the 2.2-acre rectangular plot where a red heeler, then a blue heeler, and finally a German shepherd excitedly bounced about, seeking the scent of volatile organic compounds that indicate the presence of human remains below." After about an hour, the dog's owner, Jim Peters, delivered hopeful news. Despite the challenge of detecting a scent in the gusty winds, all three dogs had alerted to 12 to 15 spots. "They showed some interest predominantly in the southern half of the rectangle," Peters, owner of Samaritan Detection Dogs in Ames, Iowa, said. "My inclination is there's some kind of odor that smells like human decomposition. It does not prove the site is a missing cemetery," he said. "There could have been some other forgotten or unknown death or event that occurred there long ago." Reinert took as a good sign searchers are on the right path. "It is very encouraging. It's just another piece of evidence," said Reinert, president of the Dakota County Historical Society. The Omadai Cemetery's location has been a mystery for decades, and Reinert began his search a few years ago after learning of it from another local historian. Dating back to 1855 or 1856, Omadai was one of the first settlements in the Nebraska Territory. The community reached a population of about 400 and was abandoned about 10 years later when residents feared the encroaching Missouri River Channel would swallow it up. Others left to seek their fortunes in Colorado after gold was discovered there. There is nothing left of Omadai, but its location east of U.S. Highway 77 is known. The site of the cemetery, where an estimated dozen or so residents were buried, was anyone's guess. "It is a matter of record that it existed. The question is where," Reinert said. In 2021, volunteers with ground-penetrating radar scanned a suspected site west of U.S. 77. They detected nothing. Then Mike Huber, a North Sioux City resident who pores over historical maps as a hobby, heard about the search and brought Reinert a copy of an aerial photo taken in the 1930s that he had discovered. It showed a rectangular area bordered by what appeared to be large stones. In a photo taken 10 years later, the rectangle was no longer visible. All signs were gone. "How do you lose a cemetery? I don't know," Reinert said. The photos helped zero in on a possible site. A year ago, half a mile from the site first searched, the ground-penetrating radar was brought back, but results were inconclusive. Reinert continued to believe the cemetery had to be there. The aerial photos convinced him it was the right place. "Unless somebody can tell me what that could be," he said, referring to the rectangles clearly seen in the 30s-era photo. A few months ago, Nebraska State archaeologist Dave Williams called Reinert, suggesting the use of cadaver dogs. Williams had worked with Peters before on locating lost burial sites. "This is just another tool in the toolkit," Williams said Thursday while Peters' dogs worked. "Finding Omadai Cemetery is important," Williams said, "because the state archaeologist office is obligated to protect unmarked burial sites. It is also a piece of early Nebraska history. It continues the story of Nebraska's history. The town of Omadai was one of the earliest established in territorial history, William said, and locating the cemetery can help families piece together their family history. Peters marked the GPS coordinates of each spot his dogs hit on and will forward them to Williams. The next step has yet to be determined. A positive hit by dogs isn't enough to say, yes, this is a cemetery, William said. The only definitive way, he said, is to excavate the site. Though it would be up to the landowner, Reinert isn't in favor of digging it up out of respect for descendants of people buried at Omadai he believes may still live in the area. His end goal, a historical marker at or near the site to make people aware of Dakota County's oldest cemetery. We need to iron this out, he said. He's caught the scent and will not leave the trail of evidence until the cemetery is found. Our next story is about Lamb Arts, and the headline is Council to Weigh Terminating Development Agreement with Lamb Arts. The Sioux City Council will be asked Monday to terminate a development agreement with Lamb Arts for the renovation of the city's first auditorium and forgive a $350,000 loan the city gave the performing arts group 7 years ago. Lamb purchased the auditorium at 625 Douglas Street in 2017, with plans to transform it into a regional theater. The auditorium, which was built in 1909, most recently housed KCAU's television studios. Red tagged since June of 2022, the building's roof began leaking in the fall of 2022 and gradually collapsed on the brick structure west side. In January, Lamb founder Diana Woolley told the Journal things will start happening very soon with the project. She said, "We are in kind of a funny spot. We are looking at everything, looking at all of our options right now. We're working daily on this. We have a developer from Omaha that we're working with. We've got a campaign guru that's helping us with funding and all that sort of thing. We've got some incredibly beautiful plans drawn up." Woolley made the comments after Benson Building developer Steve Nelson asked the council in late January to take action on the auditorium, even if it means tearing down the historic building, which is across the street from his property. Lamb paid $400,000 for the auditorium, purchasing it in November 2017 from Lois C. Archer Dunbar, according to the Sioux City Assessor's website. Woolley and her husband Russell previously told the council Lamb raised a substantial portion of the $20 million project goal and made progress towards securing various tax credits, grants, and private contributions. The city recently made a formal request to Lamb to provide a report on the old auditorium's structural condition. In October 2017, the City Council approved a $350,000 economic development loan with a 4% forgivable interest rate to Lamb to purchase the building. The loan was to be paid in full on October 22, 2018, at which time the 4% interest rate would be forgiven. Lamb announced in 2020 that it had received $500,000 from the Bluestem Fund for the project. Prior to that gift, the nonprofit theater had received grants from the Margaret Ann Martin Everest Foundation, Missouri River Historic Development, and Gilchrist Foundation, as well as a Grayfield tax credit. In February 2020, the council approved an ordinance designating the auditorium as a local landmark, which made it eligible for state historic preservation tax credits. A year later, the city also received a $300,000 grant from the Environmental Protection Agency to conduct brownfield assessments of a handful of older properties around town, including the auditorium. Lamb requested multiple extensions for the repayment of the economic development loan, which were granted by the council. The final extension required repayment of the loan on October 19, 2023. According to city documents, Lamb failed to repay the loan in full and to date has made no payments on the debt. Lamb also failed to properly maintain the building, which led to the building being deemed unsafe and placarded on June 3, 2023. City staff worked with Lamb and its representatives to negotiate a non-judicial foreclosure of the mortgage. If approved by council, the development agreement will be terminated, the mortgage released, and the promissory note forgiven. The city will be taking title to the building in lieu of foreclosure and will be assigned rights to any insurance proceeds on the building for an existing insurance claim which is under appeal, the city document stated. After further evaluation, city staff plan to bring forward recommendations for the future of the building, according to the documents. The American Legion Post 64 once owned the building and operated as the Tomba Ballroom. Last month, the council voted to terminate Lamb's lease of the former Webster School for failing to keep the building in a reasonably safe and serviceable condition. The nonprofit professional non-equity theater had been leasing the two-story brick building at 417 Market Street from the city since April 20, 2015. On February 21, 2023, the city notified Lamb that holding assemblies or classes in the building was prohibited due to life safety concerns. A draft of the termination notice, addressed by the Woolleys and signed by City Manager Bob Padmore, stated that the city did a number of inspections on the building and found that the building was not being maintained in a reasonably safe and serviceable condition. In February, Lamb announced a partnership with Morningside University to temporarily bring Lamb Theater Productions to the Sioux City College's Klinger Neal Theater at 3700 Peters Avenue. Lamb School classes will also transition to Morningside's campus, according to a statement issued by Lamb. Russell Woolley, who serves as Lamb's managing artistic director, said the decision to move all activities to Morningside University was a direct result of the deteriorating condition of their current building, a former school on the west side. "We have been producing quality live theatrical entertainment in Siouxland for 44 years. The old Webster School at 417 Market Street has served us well for 38 of those years, but that building is no longer sustainable as a venue for our productions and Lamb School classes," he said in a statement. And now we move to a story about the primary race between Feenstra and Virgil campaigns. The two GOP candidates competing in the June 4th primary for Iowa's 4th Congressional District, Randy Feenstra and Kevin Virgil, are now sparring over emails about former Representative Steve King, real hometowns, and support for Israel. The campaign for Feenstra, the two-term incumbent from Hull, sent out an email Friday morning analyzing the state of the race with Virgil, a Sutherland resident who's an Army veteran and former intelligence worker. In a section entitled, "Our Opponent," the campaign lobbed multiple accusations at Virgil he is being supported by Steve King. "Who is Kevin Virgil? Kevin Virgil was recruited by former Congressman Steve King, who Randy defeated after nearly 20 years in Congress, to move to Iowa from New York to run for Congress. Virgil has not voted in Iowa since 1992 and calls New York his adopted hometown," the email said. "Virgil also holds positions far out of the mainstream for Iowa. His business has relied on hundreds of thousands in government contracts and loans. He has praised traitors who leaked intelligence to hostile nations. He has a history of agreeing with politicians who are soft on drugs and weak on the border, and he has even praised critics of our ally, Israel." In the 2020 cycle, Feenstra defeated King in a five-person GOP primary that also included Woodbury County Supervisor Jeremy Taylor. King said in his 2022 book, Walking Through the Fire, which largely focuses on fallout from a 2019 New York Times interview in which he seemed to defend white supremacy, that he had no sour grapes but has previously referred to as Feenstra as an off-the-shelf state senator and recently accused Feenstra of fake news ads. Virgil responded to the claims from the Feenstra campaign, saying they were guilty of dishonest and misleading attacks and are afraid to face them in a debate. During the 2022 cycle, Feenstra's opponent in the general election, Ryan Melton, a Democrat from Nevada, quarreled with Feenstra about not debating. With respect to being recruited by former Congressman Steve King, Virgil said he sought King's advice before declaring and is grateful for his many years of service. He then suggested Feenstra was recruited by former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. On the hometown matter, Virgil said he was living in New York City until late last year and has been open about it. "When I learned about the unconstitutional carbon capture pipeline scam here in Iowa and how Randy Feenstra has been working hard to help Summit Carbon Solutions seize land from Century Farms and private landowners, I knew that something had to be done," he said. Regarding Feenstra's claim that I praise traitors, isn't it interesting that he doesn't mention who that traitor is? He is referring to Edwin Snowden, who I have long asserted is a great patriot. Today, thanks to Snowden, the American people know about the egregious abuses of power that our intelligence services have committed, Virgil said. Virgil then continued via email, "As for the claim that I agree with politicians who are soft on crime and praise critics of Israel, once again Feenstra does not mention who these people are. In this case, he is referring to former Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, who may yet become President Trump's running mate. In 2019, I liked a media post from Ms. Gabbard that mentioned her intent to clean up our out-of-control intelligence agencies," he said. At the close of his response, Virgil wrote, "Feenstra lies and twists the truth because he knows that his voting record is indefensible." Along with slamming Virgil, the Feenstra campaign touted the litany of endorsements it has received, including those from Governor Kim Reynolds, U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, and others. "Randy has never lost an election. He is excited to deliver a victory for Republican voters on June 4th and looks forward to helping all Republicans up and down the ballot win big in November and defeat Joe Biden and the Democrats," the memo, drafted by Feenstra campaign manager Emily Schreckrath, said. As Kevin's Big Apple Virgil travels a district attacking Randy Feenstra, "I only ask one thing. Please fuel up using Iowa biofuels." And now we move to some news briefs. Former USD basketball player sentenced to jail for rape. Vermillion, South Dakota. A former University of South Dakota men's basketball player who raped a woman in his on-campus apartment was sentenced Thursday to 6 months in jail. Miha Carcona, 21, who is from Romania, had pleaded guilty in February in Clay County Circuit Court to one count of second-degree rape. As part of a plea agreement, a 20-year prison sentence was suspended and he received the 180-day jail sentence with credit for 4 days previously served. After completing his jail sentence, Carcoana will be deported to Romania, or if his immigration status permits it, he will voluntarily return to his home country. A second count of second-degree rape and one count of interference with emergency communications were dismissed. The victim agreed to the terms of the plea agreement, according to court filings. Carcoana was arrested on December 9, 2022, hours after the woman had gone to a hospital emergency room and contacted police. She had been at the Coyote Village Student Housing Unit, where she had called friends to pick her up before Carcoana pushed her onto a bed, took her phone, and dismissed calls from her friends before forcibly having sexual contact with her. After the assault, the woman left his apartment, found her friends in the apartment building, and went to the hospital. A sophomore at the time of his arrest, Carcoana transferred to USD after playing the previous year at the University of Toledo and had appeared in each of the Coyotes' first 10 games in the 22-23 season until his arrest. He was suspended from the team after his arrest. Motorcyclist killed in Wednesday crash, Sioux City. An accident that killed a motorcyclist on Wednesday remains under investigation. At around 1:25 p.m. Wednesday afternoon, Sioux City police were alerted to the accident that occurred on U.S. Highway 20 near the Southern Hills Mall. Based on the preliminary investigation by the Sioux City police, the motorcycle driver, identified as Nicholas D. Barnes, 44, of Sioux City, was merging into the U.S. 20 westbound on the on-ramp from South Lakeport Street. Officers say it appeared the motorcycle dropped off the edge of the pavement at the end of the on-ramp, causing the motorcyclist to lose control. The motorcyclist and his vehicle went down, sliding across the traffic lanes into the median. The driver and his motorcycle were separated. The motorcycle then went into the eastbound lane, where it was hit by a truck, went into a roadside ditch where it caused a small fire. According to a news release, Barnes was not struck by any vehicle. He was transported to a local hospital with critical injuries and was declared dead at the hospital. The crash caused both eastbound and westbound traffic near US 20 to be temporarily closed on Wednesday. Goats die in rural Dakota City house barn fire. Four goats died in a fire that destroyed a rural Dakota City house and barn on Thursday. Firefighters were dispatched to 1488 Lake Avenue at 8:24 a.m. South Sioux City Fire Chief Doug Koopman whose department responded to a mutual aid request, said the barn was engulfed in flames and had collapsed by the time the first truck arrived on the scene. And because of radiant heat and wind, the side of the house had caught fire. Koopman said every room in the house had fire and smoke damage and was considered a total loss. Farm equipment stored in the barn was destroyed in addition to the loss of the goats. The cause of the fire, which started in the barn, is undetermined, Koopman said. The home's two occupants safely exited the house without injury, though one was treated at the scene for anxiety. Two firefighters were treated for exhaustion. In addition to South Sioux City, Dakota City, and Homer fire departments responded to the fire and were on scene until approximately 12:15 p.m. And our next article, Sioux City Water System Needs Fix by Suppliers. At least 12 community drinking water supplies in Iowa are unacceptably contaminated with enduring chemicals linked to various health ailments under new restrictions announced Wednesday by federal regulators. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency implemented a new drinking water standard that limits certain PFAS, or forever chemicals, to almost none. It is the first time in more than a decade that the EPA has issued a new regulation that will require Iowa water suppliers to reduce or eliminate a contaminant for public safety, said Corey McCoy, an Iowa Department of Natural Resources supervisor who oversees water supply compliance. It is a big deal, he said. PFAS persist in the environment indefinitely and can accumulate in people's bodies, potentially causing a variety of illnesses and cancers. They are used in numerous products for their ability to repel oil and water, and the vast majority of Americans are believed to have detectable amounts of them in their blood. Common sources of significant contamination include their manufacturers, such as 3M Company, landfills and airports, and other sites where firefighting foam has been used. The new federal regulation will generally require water supplies that regularly serve at least 25 people to test for PFAS within the next 3 years and to mitigate its contamination within 5 years. That can be accomplished by finding alternative sources of water or installing equipment to remove the chemicals. DNR testing in recent years of water supplies that are the most likely to be contaminated has revealed 12 that will be affected by the new rules. They include utilities that provide drinking water for residents in Buffalo, Burlington, Comanche, Davenport, Dubuque, Muscatine, Osage, Sioux City, and Tama. Also affected is the Kammerer Mobile Home Park and Bayer Crop Science near Muscatine, and a seasonal campground near Bellevue called Pestis that has some year-round residents. Several cities with contaminated water have been already working toward fixing their problem, even if their PFAS concentrations are below the new federal threshold. They include Ames, Burlington, Central City, Rock Valley, and Tama. Burlington, which draws water from the Mississippi River, might spend about $20 million on a well field and water treatment improvements. It's possible that further testing will reveal PFAS contaminations in other water supplies. There are about 1,100 community supplies in Iowa that are subject to the new federal regulation, and the DNR has now tested about 800 of them. McCoy expects that a handful more might be contaminated. Billions of dollars of federal funding are available for testing and mitigation, though it's unclear whether that will cover the costs for all Iowa water supplies. 3M agreed to pay more than $800,000 to install two deeper wells for Comanche, which lies across the Mississippi from one of the company's sites in Illinois. Sioux City is part of a pending lawsuit against PFAS manufacturers, said Brad Poots, the city's utilities director. The city has a contaminated well that provides drinking water on its south side, and it might cost about $6 million to install the new well, he said. If that's not possible, it might cost $12 million to update a water treatment facility to remove PFAS. We're just kind of setting back, waiting to see what our settlement from the lawsuit will be, and then go from there, Pute said. The new rules limit the two most prominent PFAS to 4 parts per trillion, which is slightly higher than what its current testing methods can detect in water. Three other variations are limited to 10 parts per trillion. The EPA estimates that the restrictions will benefit about 100 million people and prevent thousands of deaths. And now for some entertainment news. Dutch organist to give recital at Dort. Sue Center. As part of the Ringer Roll Organ Recital Series, Dutch organist Wilhelm van Twillert will perform an organ recital at 7:30 p.m. Saturday, April 20th, in the B.J. Hahn Auditorium at Dort University. Van Twillert has composed a number of psalm and choral arrangements and has received international awards for his works. In 2005, he won second prize and the audience prize at the Hens Composition Competition at the Bovenkirk in Kampen with his Toccata alla Chaconne for organ, according to an announcement from Dort. He won an honorary award for his sequence for choir and organ at the Polish International Composers Competition in 2007, and the following year he won the Prix Gastonnetais for the organ composition at the Concours de Composition in France. In 1976, Van Twillert was the first Dutch organist to reach the final of the Grand Prix de Chartres in France. From 1979 to 2022, Van Twillert was organist for the Johanneskerk in Amersfoort. In addition to his career as a composer, improviser, and church musician, he has also owned and directed a private music school and taught at the Municipal Academy of Music in Zwolle, according to Dort's announcement. Van Twillert's visit is sponsored by the Joan Ringerwohl Organ Recital Series, which is currently in its 11th year. The Ringerwohl Series seeks to promote the organ and its repertoire for musical education and enjoyment of students, alumni, and the community by bringing nationally acclaimed organists to Dort University. Motorcycle Club targeted due to love triangle. Woodbury County court documents filed Friday morning state that a 57-year-old Sioux City man went on a high-speed chase with a sawed-off shotgun and targeted a member of the El Forastero Motorcycle Club due to a love triangle. Sioux City police said Philip Jonas was arrested Thursday night after they received a 911 call of a man driving a maroon Ford F-150, striking multiple vehicles in the 2300 block of Douglas Street. An additional caller said the same man pointed a shotgun at him. The officer observed the vehicle and the defendant facing east at 4th and Jones, court documents state. The defendant immediately started eluding officers once a traffic stop was attempted. The defendant was traveling east on 4th, running stop signs and a red light. The defendant was traveling 25 miles per hour over the posted speed limit of 25 near 4th and Floyd. The defendant was apprehended a short time later near the 500 block of Chambers. Those court documents also state Jonas was involved in a domestic disturbance shortly before this. On April 11, 2024, the defendant made multiple calls to the victim, his wife, in a 50-minute time frame, the document states. The phone calls were threatening in nature, and the defendant stated he would return home and the outcome would not be good. The defendant did return home approximately 21 to 24 hours, leaving the roadway running over parked motorcycles belonging to himself and his son that were parked on the front yard. The defendant then fled. The defendant was later located by SCPD and was in possession of a sawed-off shotgun. Jonas admitted to shooting the shotgun at two different vehicles belonging to motorcycle club members prior to the vehicle pursuit, according to court documents. The defendant admitted to stealing the shotgun and shotgun shells from a friend's residence hours prior to the incident. The defendant admitted to sawing off the barrel of the shotgun with a hacksaw, the document said. A prosecutor alert from the county notes, Philip has multiple felony convictions and has a hatred toward El Forester's Motorcycle Club and wants them hurt. Jonas was booked and into the Woodbury County Jail and charged with 7 aggravated misdemeanor counts, including assault while displaying a dangerous weapon, and 4 Class D felonies, including going armed with intent. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, April 14th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to the obituaries. Chuck Miller, 61, of Bloomfield, Colorado, passed away peacefully, surrounded by loved ones on April 4th after a prolonged battle with cancer. Funeral services for Chuck will be held on Friday, April 12th at Nativity of Our Lord Catholic Church, Bloomfield. Born in Sioux City on September 11th, Chuck was the fifth of six children born to Dwayne and Nancy Miller. He attended Bishop Heelan High School and went on to earn a Bachelor of Science degree in finance from the University of Iowa. After graduation, Chuck moved to Denver, Colorado, where he joined a fledgling courier company called Quicksilver Express. During his 38-year career with QEC, Chuck rose from manager to CEO and fostered countless friendships with colleagues, walking into his life as he would members of his own family. Chuck never met a stranger and dedicated his life to helping others, choosing to live this world a better and brighter place. Ever the encouraging spirit, he spent the fall seasons coaching youth football and winters coaching his eldest son's Special Olympics basketball team. He found peace in the outdoors and manual labor on his mountain property and in his Catholic faith. Chuck's legacy will live on in the hearts and minds of everyone he touched, as well as those he reached but never met. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation in Chuck's name to the American Cancer Society. Grace Barbara Dickerson, 79, of South Sioux City, passed away on Tuesday, April 9th at a local nursing facility. A memorial service will be at 2 p.m. Friday, April 19th at the Moran Becker Hunt Funeral Home in South Sioux City, with Chaplain Janelle Norton officiating. Burial will be at a later date at the Newcastle City Cemetery. Visitation with the family present will be 1 hour prior to services at the funeral home on Friday. Grace was born on September 25, 1944, in Los Angeles, California, to Donald and Alice Mommer Gilbert. After graduating from Elsinore High School in California, she went on to obtain her Associate of Arts degree at Riverside City College, graduating in June of 1979. She married James Allen Dickerson on September 21, 1968, in Riverside, California. That marriage ended in a divorce. Grace relocated to Newcastle, Nebraska after meeting Virgil Hinds while he was on a trip to California. She worked alongside Virgil and enjoyed a common law marriage with him until his passing in September 2008. Grace ended her working career at Menards in Sioux City. Grace was a proud member of the Newcastle Community Club, the American Legion Auxiliary Unity 62 of Newcastle from 2016 until the time of her passing. She was an avid reader, loved to cross-stitch, enjoyed baking, playing cards, and collecting dishes. Claire Arlene Joines, formerly of Sioux City and Whiting, passed away March 29th. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, May 18th at the Whiting Congregational Church with light lunch to follow. Claire was born and raised on a century farm on November 15th, 1928, near Whiting, Iowa, to Dudley Delashmute and Edith Delashmute. She attended country school and Whiting High School before graduating from Wayne State College in 1949. Claire taught school at Akron and Cherokee, Iowa, before marrying James Jr. Joines on June 21, 1952, in Miami, Florida. Claire continued to teach school at duty locations during her husband's U.S. Naval career assignments, including Key West, Florida, Beeville, Texas, Kingsville, Texas, Oak Harbor, Washington, San Diego, California, and San Jose, California, while pursuing her further education. After her husband Jim retired from the Navy, Claire and her family returned to her hometown of Whiting in 1972, where she served on the Whiting Community School Board for 12 years, serving 9 years as board president. In 1986, she accepted a position as a disaster service coordinator for Monona County, a position she held until retiring in 2000. Claire moved to Sioux City in 2011 and had many good friends at the Country Club Apartments. In 2021, she moved to Ankeny and shared her home with her daughter, Edie Winkleman. Claire was truly the family matriarch, supporting and keeping close relationships with family members and friends who felt her unconditional love and acceptance. Memorials may be made in Claire's behalf to Taylor House Unity Point Hospice, Des Moines, Iowa. Cecil Horn, 84, of Sioux City, passed away January 29th at his residence. Memorial services will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday, April 20th at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Visitation will be 1 hour prior. Burial will be at Graceland Park Cemetery. Jimmy Kelsheimer, 85, Anthon, died Tuesday, April 9th. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Monday, April 15th. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. on Sunday, April 14th. Prayer service will be at 6:45. All of this will be at the Anthon Church of Christ in Anthon. Arrangements are by Armstrong Van Houten Funeral Home of Anthon. The burial without service for Rachel R. Starr, who died January 30th, will be at 2 p.m. Saturday, April 20th in Sioux City at Memorial Park Cemetery. A remembrance gathering will follow at Sacred Heart in the Fellowship Hall at 5010 Military Road, also in Sioux City. Daniel P. McCarthy, 93, of Sioux City, formerly of Jackson, Nebraska, passed away Thursday, April 4th at his residence. A funeral mass was held at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, April 10th at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Jackson. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 with a vigil service held at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, April 9th at Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home. Burial will be at the Calvary Cemetery in Sioux City. Daniel was born on January 27, 1931, in Randolph, Nebraska, the son of Daniel J. and Helen Lamb McCarthy. The family moved to Jackson, Nebraska, when Daniel was 9 years old, and he remained a Jackson resident until 1957, when he moved to Sioux City. He married Marilyn Ufers on May 4, 1957, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Sioux City. Marilyn passed away on November 14, 1993, in Sioux City. Daniel served in the United States Navy from 1951 to 1959, serving 4 years active duty following the Korean War and 4 years in the reserves. Following his service years, he joined the VFW in Jackson and was involved with them as well as the American Legion. Daniel graduated from high school in Jackson and received his bachelor's degree from Morningside College in 1963. Daniel worked in sales of tools and welding products for Aramid Products, Fuchs Machinery, and for several years for Sioux City Iron until his retirement. He had a very strong work ethic. In his free time, Daniel enjoyed dancing, spending time at the family farm, going to family gatherings. He also enjoyed fixing and making things from about anything. He was a jack of all trades. He was also quite a jokester and enjoyed teasing just about everyone. He was very proud of his Irish roots. His favorite Gaelic saying was when someone was about to leave was, "Dia do it," or "God go with you." The family would like to thank St. Croix Hospice for their great care of Daniel. June Marie Paranto, 92, of Sioux City, passed away surrounded by her family on April 9th. A celebration of life will be held Wednesday, April 17th at 4 p.m. at Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. June was born on June 9th, 1931, in Billings, Montana, to Harry and Margaret Fairburn. She graduated from Billings High School and then continued her education at Helena College in Montana. She worked as a nurse at several hospitals, nursing homes, and as a private caregiver. June was united in marriage to Morris Jean Paronto on November 18, 1950, in Billings. They later moved to Sioux City in 1964. In 1987, they moved to Akron. The family's farmhouse was damaged by fire in 2006, and they moved back to Sioux City. June loved to sew and spend time with her family. She was a member of Morningside Church of Christ. Patty Jane Hover, 90, of South Sioux City, passed away on March 22nd in Council Bluffs, Iowa. A funeral will be held 11 a.m. Thursday, April 18th, at Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Burial will be at the Dakota City Cemetery. Patty was born on March 2, 1934, in Rosalie, Nebraska, to Carl and Elizabeth Burke. She married the love of her life, Floyd G. Hover, in 1952. She graduated valedictorian from Rosalie in 1952 and received her bachelor's degree in education and arts. Patty was a teacher at Willis Beach School and homemaker. Patty had a love for life that radiated in her smile. She loved the Lord, her family, and big fancy hats. She will be greatly missed. And that does it for the obituaries for today. We'll now move to the opinion page, and we'll begin with the journal editorial. If you have complained about grocery prices in recent weeks, you have an idea what low-income families are facing. Nutritious food is often expensive. Less than nutritious saves money. So why then did Iowa turn down $29 million in federal funding, which would have helped those low-income families buy food for children during the summer, and replace it with a state grant program that could not possibly have as much reach? That's the question that swirled earlier this week when Governor Kim Reynolds announced her $900,000 summer meal program. It is designed to create an additional meal sites in underserved areas across the state. But the $900,000 could hardly do what $29 million would, and it probably won't reach as many young people. The summer EBT program, which started during the COVID-19 pandemic, was designed to provide free meals in the summer to students from low-income families who receive free or reduced-priced meals during the school year. It is essentially gives low-income families $40 per month in benefits during the 3 months when children are not in school. Reynolds said she did not believe the program was sustainable and did not promote nutrition. Yet, going from $29 million to less than $1 million is hardly a way to make that point. States aren't afraid to accept federal funds for infrastructure. Why would they balk at getting food money for low-income kids? We hate to say there's a political agenda, but when the 17 states who rejected the funds from the Biden administration are largely home to Republican governors, something must be afoot. We agree with the governor. The meals should be nutritious, but having less money to spend on meals might mean less meat and fresh fruits and vegetables on the menu. Further, critics have pointed out the smaller number means communities will have to compete to get a sliver of the pie. The number of eligible applicants and their proposals will determine the number and amounts of grants awarded across the state, the governor's office said. Transportation also could be a problem for those who live in rural areas without meal sites. Under the new state program, priority will be given to applicants seeking to establish new sites and schools or organizations that did not participate in the federal programs last year. Say what? Established sites could be on the short end of the stick? What about the work it will take to get a program up and running? Schools and organizations would be able to apply for up to $10,000 for the first new site, but how much of that could be chewed up by setup costs? Considering how convoluted grant programs can be, the state would have been wiser to accept the $29 million in federal funds than figure out how to create a new format that could serve everyone. Drastically reducing the amount and erecting hoops to jump through only serves to leave Iowans wanting. Our children deserve better. Now we'll go to letters to the editor. And our first letter is written by Daryl Brown from Sioux City. And Daryl writes, another opening delay at the new Woodbury County Jail. I hope no one gives this contractor praise for the terrible job he has done. Maybe local skilled labor and contractors would not have been so bad. At least it wouldn't be $20 million over budget and multiple opening delays. Think local and stay local. Maybe the board should be investigated. And again, this was written by Daryl Brown from Sioux City. Our next letter is written by Stephen Livingston from Gutenberg, Iowa. This very minute, members of our legislature are trying to sneak in a new tax on forest lands. This bill has already passed the House. Now it has to pass the Senate. Very few people even know that this is happening. Currently, forest land is not taxed, which is used to encourage landowners to preserve forest lands and not turn that land into cropland. The program has been in place since 1906 and has saved countless acres of woodlands. I do not want to make myself the bad guy here, but facts need to be exposed. If forest lands are going to be taxed, I will have no choice but to begin logging my land. This means cutting down 100-year-old oak trees just to raise money to pay the tax. Our state is planning on using your tax dollars to subsidize a CO2 pipeline across the state, as well as use eminent domain laws to take land from anyone that won't give it up. Do you know what consumer CO2 naturally without any harmful side effects? Trees. It makes zero sense to start taxing trees now. Woodland owners do not get government funds like CRP cropland does. The minimum the state can do is not start charging us for growing trees. Protect our trees and our natural resources and contact your state senators today and tell them to stop this anti-environmental tree-killing bill. And again, this was written by Stephen Livingston from Gutenberg, Iowa. And now we move to the regulars columns. And today's is by David Hollis, who is a commitment to community involvement. He has recently serving on the boards of Leadership Siouxland, Safe Place, the Sioux City Public Library, and is currently on the board of trustees of the Sioux City Public Museum. He is also the pastor at St. Mark Lutheran Church, ELCA, in Sioux City. And in today's column, he writes about the warming shelter. On an unseasonably warm day in February, there was a celebration on Nebraska Street in downtown Sioux City. The staff of the warming shelter was shouting praises as a young man took a big step and headed to Minnesota to participate in a treatment program. The warming shelter staff cared deeply for Chatier and rejoiced in his motivation to move to a new chapter of life. On a sunny but cold day in March, there was another celebration on Nebraska Street. A young man named Emmanuel had spent many, many nights at the warming shelter. On this day, his hard work and determination was paying off, and he was ready to move to a place he could call home. There is much to learn about the warming shelter. I recently was invited to join the organization's board of directors. I said yes because it was important for me, while often driving north on Nebraska Street, to not always drive quickly by. For over 10 years, the warming shelter has saved lives by providing a safe haven for Siouxland people experiencing homelessness. In the past months, the warming shelter has housed over 100 individuals every night, with a peak of 150-plus when the weather is coldest. Recently, Shayla Moore, executive director of the warming shelter, shared this open letter to the community. In a heartening milestone for the Siouxland community, the local warming shelter has recently marked 10 years of providing essential shelter to those in need since its doors first opened in 2013. This vital facility dedicated to offering refuge has become a beacon of hope for the unsheltered population in the region. Since its inception, the warming shelter has provided temporary emergency shelter for men, women, and families who have no other shelter options in the Siouxland area. What sets the warming shelter apart is an unwavering commitment to inclusivity. Doors and compassion are available to anyone seeking shelter, recognizing that everyone deserves a place to call home, even if only temporarily. Perhaps even more remarkable is the fact that since the warming shelter's establishment, there have been zero reported deaths in Siouxland resulting from individuals being exposed to the extreme cold without shelter. This notable achievement underscores the effectiveness and importance of the warming shelter and highlights the community's commitment to ensuring the well-being of all. Joe Twidwell, member of the Warming Shelter's Board of Directors, has extensive knowledge about and compassion for people experiencing homelessness. Here are his insights about truths and myths. Not true. Homeless people choose to be on the street rather than in available housing. True. The availability of adequate low-income and transitional housing is very limited in Siouxland. Recent apartment fires, apartment building closures, and red-tagged housing units have provided added multiple challenges. Not true. The number of homeless people in Siouxland has greatly increased over the last 20 years. True. Since 2008, the community has conducted a point-in-time count of sheltered and unsheltered people experiencing homelessness on a single night in January. This count plays a crucial role in assessing and addressing homelessness. In 2014, 29 unsheltered persons, 140 persons in emergency shelters, and 128 persons in transitional housing, total 297. In 2024, 21 unsheltered persons, 253 persons in emergency shelters, and 22 persons in transitional housing, which is a total of 296. Not true. Homeless shelters in Sioux City draw people here from communities outside of Siouxland. And that was true. Most homeless people in Siouxland are not strangers. They were born or raised here or came to Siouxland to be near family or to work. A recent survey determined that nearly 60 to 80% of those considered homeless were either born or raised in Siouxland. Not true. Other communities are loading buses with their homeless and sending them to Sioux City. True. There is absolutely no evidence that other communities are sending large groups of homeless people to Sioux City. It is true that other cities send individuals to Sioux City when social service agencies can verify that these people have family or a potential job here. Interestingly, Sioux City Neighborhood Services provided 102 bus tickets last year to send individuals in similar circumstances to other communities. And then a question. Why don't homeless people just get a job? Answer. Many do if they can. Of the homeless people residing at the warming shelter, approximately 20% are employed, and approximately 40% of those at the Gospel Mission are employed. Of the remaining residents, approximately 15% suffer from some form of physical disability. Other factors include transportation, job skills, and health issues. There is much more for all of us to learn about the challenges many people face regarding home and the ways in which our community should and can respond. One important note, many people confuse those in need, those who panhandle, and those who are homeless. Most panhandlers are not homeless, and very, very few of the warming shelter or the Gospel Mission residents panhandle. I am convinced that our community support and investment in the warming shelter will result in increased safety for all, a decrease of homeless people seeking refuge in public spaces, and a reduction in the strain on emergency services, including law enforcement, hospitals, and emergency rooms, as individuals have access to a more appropriate and supportive environment. On any day, warm or cold, sunny or cloudy, people that you will meet on Nebraska Street at the warming shelter are our neighbors. Those that find shelter there have stories, needs, challenges, and hopes. The staff is compassionate and hardworking. The warming shelter's cooperative efforts and the partnerships with other helping agencies, law enforcement, area businesses, volunteers, and generous donors are commendable. And again, that was written by one of the journal's regulars, David Hollis. And now we'll move to Dear Abby, and our first letter is, my boyfriend and I have dated for 7 months. We have a good relationship in terms of compatibility. We are both Christian and educated, and we have good professions. We are fun-loving, and both of us like to invest and to travel. He enjoys my company and says I am the girl with the best qualities he's ever dated. But I do have one issue. He stays in close contact with his former on-and-off girlfriend of 10 years and other women he dated. When I asked him about it, he said he... An example. Last year, when he was single, he wanted to take his long-term ex-girlfriend out for a day trip, dinner, and a musical so she could get away from her apartment. Her daughter and grandkids, who were living with her, made her life very tough. My boyfriend and this ex also text each other often to keep up with each other's family and life. I feel uneasy about this. Wouldn't most women? To me, if you don't think a relationship is working, you should stop seeing each other so you don't cause more confusion or stir up more emotion. How should I deal with this? I like this guy a lot, and I really think we have something going. And signed, sharing him in Texas. And Abby's reply. When people end long-term relationships, they don't all do it in the same way. Some of them have a dramatic blow-up and never speak to the person again. Others remain friends for many years. If your boyfriend's former flame has an adult daughter and grandkids, none of you are inexperienced kids yourselves. If you really want a future with him, you may have to accept that he won't be happy if you try to curtail his social contacts. If you cannot summon up enough self-confidence to manage that, perhaps you should find someone else. Dear Abby, I'm a 68-year-old married man with no close friends. I worked for 35 years in my family-owned bar and restaurant until they lost it. After that, I worked as an assistant manager in a few fast food places, then as an assistant manager in a major pharmacy. At 65, after 3 knee surgeries and a foot fusion, I retired from working full-time. I now work part-time for a physical therapy center, mostly to keep busy and make a few bucks. I have no hobbies or major interests. I have a few health issues which are under control. I feel lonely most of the time. I know a lot of people and get along with people. I just feel lonely. I have two sons I'm very proud of who have families of their own, but they're busy with their lives. I have no one to talk to who won't judge me for feeling the way I do. Can you give me any direction on where to turn? Signed, A Bit Lonely in the East. And the reply, you say you are married. Is it a happy marriage? You also have part-time employment. Those are things to be grateful for. Your persistent loneliness may be something to mention to your doctors. The problem could be emotional, spiritual, physical. It may simply be boredom. But the place to start would be a doctor or a spiritual advisor to help you get to the bottom of this. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, April 14th. I'm your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.